Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. And now a conversation with Will Haygood, the man behind The Butler. The longtime Boston Globe and Washington Post journalist was held hostage during the war in Somalia, stood outside the prison when Nelson Mandela was released, spent weeks in New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina, and has written books on Adam Clayton Powell, Sammy Davis Jr., and Sugar Ray Robinson, among others. One of his most well-known Washington Post profiles of a man who served as White House butler for 8 presidents, from Truman to Reagan, became the inspiration for the movie now in theaters, Lee Daniels, The Butler. In the movie, he's known as Cecil Gaines. In real life, Eugene Allen. Will Haygood, welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So your article, by way of background for people who don't know, A Butler Well Served by This Election, ran 3 days after President Obama won the 2008 election. And I've heard that you'd actively set out to find a black person who'd worked in the White House for many years specifically to write about, and that's how you found Eugene Allen. Were you really that specific in what you wanted to write and about whom?
Well, yes, it started. I was on the Obama campaign plane in 2008, and there was a rally in North Carolina. After the rally, I walked outside. It was after midnight, and I saw some young ladies. They were crying. I asked them if there was anything I could do. They said they were crying because their fathers did not want them supporting this African-American candidate. These young ladies happened to have been white, and they were defying their fathers. It was a very powerful moment to me, and later that night in my hotel room, I just said to myself, it just feels like a movement. This could spread from town to town, city to city, state to state. That's a very powerful thing to stand up to your father in the South, where fathers are mythical, very mythical. And so I said to myself, I just said to myself that Obama was going to win. And even though he was down 10 points or more still in the polls, I just thought he was going to win. And I said, to juxtapose his victory, his looming victory, I wanted to find somebody who worked in the White House during the era of segregation, a laundry worker, person who shined shoes, person who ironed clothes in the White House, or a maid or a butler. And after a long search, I came upon Eugene Allen.
Who was hired during the Truman administration?
Yes, as a dishwasher. And he rose up the ladder through 8 presidents, and he was appointed the maitre d', which is like the chief butler under the Reagan administration, by President Reagan and First Lady Nancy Reagan. So his life really consisted of an amazing sweep of American history.
So, listeners, if you have any questions for Will Haygood, the phones are open. Maybe you've seen Lee Daniels' The Butler and you want to talk about the film, or maybe you've read his original article, or if you're just a fan of Will Haygood's other writing and books, give us a call. We'll have time to talk not just about The Butler, but some of his other life experiences in journalism around the world, and his biographies of Sammy Davis Jr., Sugar Ray Robinson, Adam Clayton Powell. 212-433-WNYC on any of that. 212-433-9692 for your chance to talk with legendary reporter Will Haygood. For those who saw the movie, Will, but haven't read your article or vice versa, it's worth noting that the film makes a number of embellishments to the story, not uncommon for Hollywood. One character the movie invents is the older son, who's there to highlight the clash in generations. He's critical of his father as being content for serving white people. His father is critical of him for participating in what he sees as the radical civil rights efforts of the mid-60s. Did the real butler, Eugene Allen, have these sort of mixed feelings himself about civil rights efforts or any real-life family conflict that you found?
Oh, yes. I mean, anybody who is stripped right to vote who has to use segregated drinking fountains or segregated hotel rooms would feel dismayed that they are still a second-class citizen. Mind you, he worked at the most powerful address in the world, right. 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and he could leave there and go 30 miles into Virginia or Maryland all through the 50s up until the 1964 Civil Rights Bill, and he would be treated like a second-class citizen. So, there were tidal waves of emotion spearing through his body and mind every day. My goodness, it was President Johnson sent his only son, Charles Allen, to Vietnam. And just think of that. You have a butler walking up the steps in the White House to the bedroom of the president to deliver him his newspapers or his Pepto-Bismol or whatever, and you're staring at the very man who had sent your only son to Vietnam.
In a war that Eugene Allen opposed, do you know?
I don't know that for sure. He was very patriotic. Never missed a day of work. Served 8 presidents. Had fond things to say about all of them. When it appeared to him that his country did not love him as much as he loved his country, he never quit. Never changed jobs. Loved his job and loved serving the country. Working at the White House.
Did he share his political views with presidents?
No, he was he was trained not to do that. But when I knocked on their door, he and his wife, Helene, their modest home was full of magazine covers and stories and even books. About then Senator Barack Obama, and they were energetically supportive of his candidacy, and they had told me, both of them had told me that they said, well, we're quite on in years now, but if he wins, and we're praying that he does, it sure would be nice to get an invitation to the White House to meet him
as something other than a butler.
Yes, absolutely.
But he never talked to the presidents he had intimate access to, even about civil rights, even about Vietnam when his son was sent?
Yes, there were moments, of course. For instance, when the Nat King Cole show was canceled, it was President Eisenhower had asked Mr. Allen in the TV room to turn the channel to the Nat King Cole show because he liked that show, and he couldn't find it. So he turned to Mr. Allen and said, "Hey, Gene, what's up with the Nat King Cole show?" And he said, "Oh, Mr. President, it's been canceled." And he said, "Why on heavens, why?" And he had to explain to him, Mr. Allen did, that Southern advertisers pulled their funding for that half-hour show. And so it was a direct result of the advertisers in the South who did not want to support a show that featured a black man, even as accomplished, as famous as Nat King Cole. And so Mr. Allen sought to explain that to President Eisenhower. And I think those moments like that certainly affected President Eisenhower's thinking, he hired the first African-American, E. Frederick Morrow, to work in the White House in a suit and tie position. It was a low-level executive position, but he was considered a special assistant to the president. It didn't get a lot of press at the time. I researched a book on Adam Clayton Powell and went to New York City back in 1992 and sat in the apartment with Mr. Morrow. And that gave me great insight into the 1950s.
My guest on WNYC, Will Haywood, the journalist, who wrote the original profile of White House butler Eugene Allen, which was the inspiration for the new movie, Lee Daniels' The Butler, where the butler's character is called Cecil Gaines. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Roy in Kearney wants to follow up about the son being sent to Vietnam. Hi, Roy.
Hi, Brian. Thank you guys for taking my call. Yeah, I was just curious about that tidbit of the movie as to whether or not it was actual or was just added in. And was the young lady who played the revolutionary Angela Davis, or was that just some figure that fell within the film's desire to make it more exciting?
Roy, thank you. Was the son, I haven't seen the film, so was the son killed in Vietnam in the movie, Will? Roy, that was that what you told our screener?
Yes, exactly.
Did that happen in real life?
Well, now, this is a spoiler alert for your listeners, so if you want me to to reveal a spoiler alert, I will, but I think it'd be more interesting for
people
to go see the movie and
find
out.
I respect spoiler alerts,
yeah.
So we don't have to go there. So let's just take another – well, do you want to answer the other part of his question?
Yes. I think a lot of people think that character is modeled on Angela Davis, and because of the big beautiful afro and the actress Yaya Leifia just turns in a stunning performance. She's just a wonderful actress, but I just think it was a character written by the very gifted Emmy award-winning screenwriter Danny Strong. That came from his mind. He really researched the period in the era, and he really got the explosiveness of the 1960s masterfully, I think.
Sandy in Stamford. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sandy.
Good morning, gentlemen. I was wondering if Will had been contacted by Lee Daniels as an expert on the subject of Eugene Allen, and was he asked to consult at all on the film? And then secondly, I had heard from a friend that the reconciliation between Eugene Allen and his son never actually happened in real life. She had heard an interview with the son, and was that, I don't know that that's a spoiler alert again, so whether you feel you want to answer that or not, but I felt it was a very touching moment in the film and made the group of us feel good, and I wondered if we were manipulated a little bit.
Thank you very much, and too late to warn anybody against that spoiler alert, but Will, go ahead.
Yes, well, the movie is inspired by the life of Eugene Allen, so it's a blend of fact and fiction, but all of the history in the movie, the Vietnam War and the presidents that he served, all of that is fact-based. So that answers that. The other question, you asked me if Lee Daniels got in touch with me or if I got in touch with him. Lee Daniels directed the movie. So Laura Ziskin and Pam Williams, the two producers, they were the ones who hired Lee Daniels to direct the movie. I think he's done a phenomenal job. The reviews have been great, thank goodness. But yes, I was on the movie set while the movie was being filmed, and I'm also one of the associate producers of the movie. So I hope that answers your question.
Sandy, thank you for your call. 212-433-WNYC if you want to talk to Will Haygood. You wrote that in 1963, the issue of race bedeviled this White House, even amid good intentions, unquote. And you tell the story of how Sammy Davis Jr. was invited, then uninvited, then reinvited to a state dinner, all because he was in a mixed-race relationship. All this at the same time that Kennedy was seen as quite progressive on race policy. You want to tell that story?
Yes. Sammy Davis Jr. was invited to the White House by the Kennedy administration. There was an event, 100th year anniversary of the
Emancipation Proclamation. Right,
yeah.
And of course we're all celebrating 150 years and 50 years since the march in 63 and all of that, so on our minds this week.
Yes, and so it was President Kennedy was alarmed because he had a lot of support in the South, Southern senators. He wanted to keep them on board to try to pass some of his social legislation, and he was irate that Sammy Davis Jr. had come to the White House with May Britt, his Swedish-born wife, and there were no photographs allowed. If President Kennedy did not want any photographs taken in the White House of the black Sammy Davis and the white May Britt, so there were not. Now, First Lady Jackie Kennedy was very upset at this and stormed upstairs to her bedroom, and she eventually came back down, but she let the president know that she was not happy with what he had done. He had made Sammy Davis Jr. feel very uncomfortable, and of course, we know years later, Sammy Davis Jr. Supported President Nixon. So there are roots as to why he switched parties.
And Claire on our comments page writes, this is almost a follow-up to that last question about Kennedy, why was Lyndon Johnson treated so comically in the movie when he was the one who was responsible for getting the most important civil rights legislation passed? His portrayal was offensive, she writes. It perpetuates the myth that JFK was the great civil rights leader when, in fact, it was Johnson's will, heart, and political and legislative acumen that were responsible for the laws passing. What would you say to that listener?
I just don't see it that way. There's a beautiful scene with President Johnson giving his great voting rights speech, saying, "We shall overcome." And that's a very moving moment in the movie. And I think he's given full credit if the writer who has written this post doesn't like, you know, that there is some laughter. I mean, there was laughter in the White House. It wasn't always a very severe place. It was laughter there, but, you know, I just thank her for going to see the movie, and I somewhat pleasantly disagree that the movie was offensive to Johnson. I think there's no doubt that in regards to civil rights, LBJ was a titanic force and had a political genius to get the 1964 Civil Rights Bill passed and the 1965 Voting Rights Act passed. He has no equal in terms of civil rights except President Lincoln. Unequivocally, he has no equal. He changed this nation's course.
We will continue in a minute with the legendary Washington Post reporter Will Haygood, who, among so many other things, wrote the profile of White House butler Eugene Allen, who served from Presidents Truman to Reagan, that inspired the movie now in theaters, Lee Daniels, the Butler. And we'll continue to talk about that and some of his other work, including his biographies of Adam Clayton Powell, Sammy Davis Jr., Sugar Ray Robinson. When we continue, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer, WNYC. As we continue with Will Haygood of The Washington Post, he wrote the article that inspired the new movie, The Butler. He has also reported from Somalia and New Orleans after Katrina. He was there when Nelson Mandela was released from prison in South Africa as a foreign correspondent. And he has written books about Sammy Davis Jr., Adam Clayton Powell, and Sugar Ray Robinson. Let me ask you about your books. Why those three? An athlete, a politician, a musician, did they have something in common?
They were each, in my mind, unexplored as far as literary terms go. And as a journalist, I wanted to dive deep into their lives. And after each biography, as I would go into my next one, I would say I wanted to be vastly different from the previous book. So that's why there was a politician, and then I swerved to an entertainer, and then I swerved to an athlete. And my most recent biography is called The Butler, A Witness to History. That's the book I've written about Eugene Allen that has just been published.
Simultaneously with the film. So we should say that. Is that an e-book? I read that's an e-book. Is that correct?
No.
Oh, you have an actual book. There's a physical book. Oh, I should have said that 25 times by now.
Yes, it's a hardback book. Simon & Schuster published it, and there's a foreword. The introduction to the book is written by Lee Daniels, by the director. And, yes, it's knock wood, it just hit the New York Times bestseller list, so I'm very happy about that. I just found that out yesterday. But it's called The Butler, A Witness to History. In it...
So, a boxer, an entertainer, a politician, and a butler.
And a butler...
Walk into a bar and there's a joke in there somewhere.
Yeah, Brian, you're right.
But how about the other three? You felt they were unexplored from a literary standpoint.
Yes. I really did, and there's roots as to why I wrote the Adam Clayton Powell book. I got a what's called an Upward Bound scholarship when I was in high school, and I had heard all these bad things about Adam Clayton Powell. He died in 1972. I came out of high school in 1972 and went to college for 4 years, and later found out that as the chairman of the Education and Labor Committee, Adam Clayton Powell was a driving force behind the Upward Bound program. So I just told myself, I just said, hey, I owe this man a debt because, you know, for all of his flaws, you know, he had a kind of political genius, and he cared about poor kids. And I came up in a poor family, first one in my family to go to college. And so I just told myself that I owed him a debt, and I wanted to write that book. With Sammy Davis Jr., when I was coming up, lived with my grandparents and my mother, there were very few blacks on daily television. And my grandmother and mother would call me if I was outside playing, you know, as a kid in the 60s. They would call me and say, hey, you have to come in the house. Harry Belafonte is on TV. Mm-hmm. Sidney Poitier is on TV. Sammy Davis Jr. is on TV. It was one of those three, it seemed like, were the...
If it was anybody.
If it was anybody, it was one of those three. And with Sugar Ray Robinson, my uncle, Ira, was a Golden Gloves boxer, and I used to sit at home with my grandmother, and she would... she would tell me stories about him and why she never went to see his matches because it would make her cry. And so I was very close to my Uncle Ira. My father was absent, and my Uncle Ira became a surrogate father, so I wanted to write the Sugar Ray Robinson book for him. And so
would his matches make her cry because he was so good, she was so proud, or because he was getting beat up, or what made her cry?
Yep, he was getting hurt.
Yeah.
You know, and as a matter of fact, after about 2 years, she convinced him to stop boxing, and he did.
Mm-hmm. Robert in Rego Park, you're on WNYC with Will Haygood. Hello.
Ryan, how you doing, guy? My question is, you know, Sammy Davis is a great singer, was a great dancer. In writing your book, did you discover the essence of his spirituality? Was he into, you know, God and religion?
Yes, but first, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because before I actually started on the book, I would go to these used record stores all around the country, and I would get vinyl albums, because a lot of the vinyl albums, they would have long essays written by some music critic. Brian certainly knows this. And, you know, you would open the albums, and there would be these long essays about Sammy Davis Jr. at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas in 1952, or at the Copacabana in New York City. And so I had a great appreciation for his singing. That's an underappreciated part of Sammy Davis Jr.'s life. The man could sing jazz standards and, you know, pop tunes, and he was caricatured so much that we forget that he was a genuinely gifted singer. His religion was somewhat all over the place. He did convert
to Judaism.
He became Jewish. Yes, yes. And his religion was sort of all over the place. But when he converted. And he practiced the Jewish faith, it seemed to have rooted him. It seemed to him and to his friends that Sammy had found a religious calling that he could love and that he could honor and that he could benefit from.
Was he comfortable with his role? I think, as you write, he endured humiliation from his fellow Rat Pack members at times. He marched with King, but then hugged Nixon. And I think you convey a sense that in many ways he was mostly trying to fit in. Is that unfair?
No. I think that's terrific insight. He was, you know, he grew up on the road with his vaudeville father and Will Mastin. His mother was absent all of his life. He was always searching for love. And he always wanted to be loved. He never went to school. And you know, he was mocked a lot. You know, he was, he wasn't Sidney Poitier handsome or Harry Belafonte handsome. He was Sammy Davis Jr. Mm-hmm. handsome, and I don't think he was always comfortable with that. Like a lot of entertainers, I don't think it's a secret to say he felt most comfortable on stage. Mm-hmm. He used to get a lot of hate mail, a lot of death threats. You know, for the simple fact he had a lot of white female admirers, and he would get vicious letters, and it would just turn my stomach to read some of those letters.
Curtis in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Will Haygood. Hi.
Hi, Will. Great to be able to share a moment with you. I loved your book, King of the Cats,
Thank you.
Life and Times of Adam Clayton Powell. Somebody told me it's the best political biography ever written, and I do believe it.
Wow, thank you.
And so I think you paid the debt to him. It's so interesting. I learned so much from that book. As you said, or Brian said, Adam Clayton Powell is responsible for so much of the legislation we associate with the Great Society.
Yeah.
He really got it done. And I wonder two things. One, if Powell's endorsement of Eisenhower might have figured in to Eisenhower's decision to take such a firm stand in Little Rock. And also, did they ever find his medallion?
Okay.
And that's school integration that required the deployment of U.S. troops in 1954 in Little Rock, just for people who don't know that top-line history, right?
Yes. The Supreme Court decision came down in 1954, but the troops actually arrived in Little Rock in 1957.
57.
Yeah. I think Eisenhower was so caught off guard by Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus's reluctance to ensure safety of the black students. I think Eisenhower knew that he had to send federal troops in. I think Adam Clayton Powell felt vindicated, as you mentioned, that he had supported Eisenhower. And I think history has shown it's one of the moral high marks of the Eisenhower years. Now, Adam Clayton Powell was given a medallion by Emperor Haile Selassie. He hung it around his neck in the mid-60s. It meant a lot to him. And when he died in Miami, Florida, it got lost. And I looked for it. I went to Florida looking for it and knocking on various doors of people who had seen Powell in his dying days, and I thought I would come up with it, but I didn't. And so that medallion is still out there someplace lost or someplace, but I never found it.
All right. One more call, then we're out of time with Will Haygood. John in Greenwich Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi there. I want to mention a couple of things, Will. I love the movie, The Butler, and I grew up a white kid in the South. I was about 10 years old so I saw through a child's eyes the events leading up to the civil rights legislation, and it really affected me greatly my entire life. And I just want to say I think it's very important that children see this film, American children see this film. And I also wanted to offer you something else, Will. I have a direct quote from Nat King Cole when he was asked about how he felt when his TV show was canceled, or why his TV show was canceled. And he said, "Madison Avenue is the fate of the dark."
Oh, my goodness. Oh, how haunting that is. Thank you for sharing that. Wow.
And what a point on which to end.
Yes.
With yes. Will Haygood, Washington Post correspondent. Tell me exact title of the book, how it was released.
The Butler, A Witness to History.
Without the name Lee Daniels there, right? People who want to buy that book shouldn't search Lee Daniels, right?
No. But they should see Lee Daniels, The Butler, the movie, beautifully written by Danny Strone.
Based on the original reporting by Will with one L, Haygood, HAYGOOD, yes. Author of The Butler, A Witness to History, now on the New York Times bestseller list. Thank you very much for spending this time with us.
I've so enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer in WNYC. And coming up next, our fatal relationship with immortality. Stay tuned.